On BCFM 93.2. Online, on digital, on smart speaker, on app, and all over Bristol on 93.2 FM. Your one-stop shop for news.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. A third set of bribery charges filed by the police against Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, the Haaretz paper this week, leading on a demand for him, having now lost all credibility, according to them, to step down immediately. Instead, Bibi doubles down by hopping into bed with the extreme right Kahanis Party, Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power Party, who some say believe in a Zionist master race. And also, Home Secretary Sahid Javid is banning the political wing of Hezbollah, whose place now in the Lebanese government and parliament grew from the militias resisting the 2006 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. A Jewish Power, by the way, have been out of the Knesset for 30 years or so, but as a result could be back after next month's Israeli elections. Plus, from last week, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro is a US rabbi, just one of many who have very different ideas about what we hear in the mass media and what the Jewish identity means, what the Israeli state and the Zionists are telling us. And his audience fills a US stadium. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. Former microwave technology worker Mark Stevens from Gateshead takes a critical look at what the 5G networks could mean, hacking our homes and for our health this week. More also on the Magnitsky Act. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download the show from dialectradio.co.uk. But also to Venezuela. The BBC's bias on reporting events there has horrible echoes from Iraq, Libya and Syria, etc. Totally one-sided, with no mention of the US sanctions on Venezuela or the hundreds of millions in the Bank of England of Venezuelan money which the bank is withholding. So we hopefully find an expert on South America and the antics of the US and the NATO empire to ask what extent Venezuela's problems are of their own making and how much support within his country Maduro really has. And I hope I'm joined on the line now by Andre Vilcek. Andre, are you there?
Hi, Tony. Yes, I am here.
Okay, fantastic. What about your take on what's been going on over the last few weeks in Venezuela? The first question really being, to what extent could we say that Maduro is a legitimate president or isn't he?
Tony, Maduro is totally legitimate president. He won elections again and again. He won recent elections with around 68%. And what you hear in England, actually, is from mass media, is a total propaganda. Look, there is no country in the world that would have so many referendums as Venezuela. They put everything through the plebiscites. Every little change of the constitution, every change of laws, they have constant elections, and more elections they have, more they are being accused by the West of being dictatorial. And that's actually the plan. That's precisely what the West is doing with all democratic governments in Latin America, except that Venezuela is the most democratic of them. And that's obviously what you don't hear from the mass media at all. You hear the opposite.
So what about the terrible problems that have been happening inside Venezuela? Why those?
Well, that I can explain to you very easily. This is precisely what is happening since the coup against President Allende in Chile in 1973, coup that was financed and triggered by the Chase Manhattan and ITT and of course Kissinger and the others. basically you create the situation when so-called economy screams. You create deficits, you create all sorts of problems, and you demonize which are great and totally pro-Western, and they would do absolutely anything to destroy their own country because they serve the West. They don't serve their own people. So that's how it's done. These people actually own businesses. They own distribution supermarkets, agricultural companies, the mass media, and they actually would rather lose in very actually uncapitalistic way, because they are feudals, they are not capitalists. Even they would rather lose tens of millions of dollars than to lose power. So they start choking the economy. They start creating deficits of food, of consumer goods, of even of toilet paper. And then they say, you see, this is the problem of the left wing government. And this is happening again and again and again, and people in the West don't seem to notice, or they don't want to notice it.
What about outside influences? Because we've just seen a change of government in Brazil, and the US has been extremely busy. I suppose it's AMERICOM, the Pentagon's branch which tries to manage South America, in next door Colombia too. But the most recent change is Brazil. What does that mean for Maduro?
Well, I exactly spoke about this on RT yesterday. Brazil had to go off the way. The West basically triggered a constitutional coup against Dilma Rousseff. Then, again, with the Brazilian elites, they made sure that Lula da Silva, the most popular politician in Brazil from the Workers' Party, from the left, would end up in jail. So all this led to the constitutional coup in Brazil, election of the fascist president and the government, and basically, Brazil of the way, anything can now happen in Latin America. Because, they speak about the U.S. as a world cop that nobody elected, but Brazil was a good cop for Latin America. It's the most populous nation with around 200 million. It used to be socialist for more than a decade, and whenever there was some problem of tremendous importance, like when Santa Cruz province in Bolivia tried to secede, Brazil said that it will happen only over their dead body and that they are going to send the troops and support democratically elected government in La Paz of Evo Morales. So the same thing would happen definitely if Lula would be now president of Brazil. There would be such a tremendous support from Maduro that nobody would dare to really even speak about the military action or military intervention against Venezuela. Of course, there is Mexico now, the biggest Spanish-speaking country in the world, and President Obrador was elected last year. He's a socialist, he's left-leaning a person, but as we all know, Mexico is right next to the United States, and Obrador has to be a chess player. He has to actually very carefully balance between not getting assassinated themselves and to support President Maduro and other left-wing leaders in Latin America.
What about the wider picture, though, in Latin America? Because it does seem as if the Pentagon does, and the US particularly, cast an enormous shadow over the southern half of the continent. To what extent do you think Trump is behind this? Or is there a sort of military-industrial complex Pentagon machine that churns away whoever the president is?
Yes, well, both. I think under Obama we were very often wondering if they forgot about Latin America because they were spreading terror in other parts of the world. But, they never forget the leaders or the entire machinery or the complex that creates this regime, that Western-sponsored the global regime. They never forget. And Latin America went too far from their point of view. There is, of course, Monroe Doctrine, and there is pragmatic interest in controlling Venezuela is often mentioned as a country which is so rich in terms of oil and natural gas and other raw materials that they could supply oil for 30 years to the entire world. It's incredible what they found in the Orinoco Basin. But I always say that, yes, of course, this is one of the reasons, but it's not the only reason. Let's not forget that there is really fundamentalist ideological reason in the US or UK or in France. It's really the need and desire to control the whole world politically and ideologically. And that part is always kind of overlooked by the soft left. They always talk about oil, they talk about natural resources, but the fundamentalist factor and the fact of the way the West is brainwashed by really this desire to control, and by its belief that it's exceptional and democratic and all this, it should never be underestimated. Venezuela is a very dangerous country for those who feel like that, because it's a real Latin American ideological powerhouse. They believe in a great motherland of Latin American countries. It's a left-wing government. So I'm sure that two factors here are playing such an important role, and they are trying to destroy Venezuela by all means. They tried it in a softer way in the past. There was already one U.S. coup directly, trying to imprison Hugo Chavez and bringing another just a clown to the top of the country, and now it's happening the second time. Look, the same thing happened to Syria, because Syria is a pan-Arabic nation. The same thing happened to Libya, because it was a pan-Africa, center of pan-Africanism. So they are really afraid of these things. It's basically probably the most important factor, maybe more important than oil.
Well, okay, so you talk about this Western-sponsored global regime. Well, they've got a little bit of a poke in the eye from the United Nations with the vetoes on the US resolution by both Russia and China. Where is this Western-sponsored global regime you talk about, if it exists? Where is it actually based? Who is doing the thinking behind it, and what's the overall objective?
I don't see it as strictly American game. I think in UK you are greatly involved in it too. So is France. I mean, basically, it's a continuation of colonialism that Europe was spreading all over the world for 500 or more years. I mean, I always say, just look at the map of the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, there was not hardly any free country in the world. It was all plundered, massacred by genocidal European colonialism. So country like UK, they are very much behind the propaganda. That's why British propaganda is so much effective and so much vicious than the American one. I mean, Americans are just doing the vulgar and dirty job most of the time, but the entire ideology of this Western regime comes from the places like UK or France. You know, I'm just now in LA. I'm working with a great left-wing American philosopher, John Cobb, on our next book, and I'm actually in his place. That's why the noises. And we are. I hardly come to the United States, or I try not to come, but at least once a year I come to show films or to speak and all that. And, you know, I read the LA Times, and it's disgusting, but so is New York Times. But it's not as disgusting as reading the British publications online. I mean, just opening the Guardian or web pages of the Guardian or the background material that you sent to me, it's just unbelievable. And it's shocking that people in UK are actually not rolling on the floor laughing or throwing up, because it's really beyond any. This is beyond anything that we experienced in the last decades. Even if you read, look, I grew up in communist Czechoslovakia, and I was born in Soviet Union. I'm used to what in the West they call massaging of the facts or even propaganda, but it's nothing. It was not the language that the UK mass media is using now. Is so much more vitriolic and so much much less objective than what we were getting even in the Eastern Europe.
Okay, so what have you taken objection?
How can you eat the stomachs?
But what have you taken objection to? I sent you a couple of articles. One was about the, I think it's around about £1 billion of Venezuelan money that the Bank of England is sitting on, which could, of course, be being used to aid the country. They won't. Bank of England's Governor Mark Carney won't release. And it's also the suspension from the Labour Party this week of the Labour MP Chris Williamson over charges of anti-Semitism. Now, he was the person who was the main Labour Party spokesperson, really backing Maduro, saying, look, we don't want regime change in Venezuela, thank you.
I know, no, I'm talking about the first material you said about the Bank of England. I mean, it's not about the facts. It's about the language, how they describe the government of Venezuela, how they describe the problems, how they define the problems that Venezuela is facing. There is nothing about what we talked about 15 minutes ago, that how the crisis, so-called crisis, was triggered, how it was created. It's all basically blaming the government. It's government shooting the people, the protesters. I mean, who are these protesters? What is the aid? The entire Latin America knows what the aid is. The reason some countries like Argentina or Brazil or Colombia are actually supporting the Western narrative is because it's to their interest. But nobody has any doubts that there is no aid. It's basically just a way to break into Venezuela. This is how the weapons used to be smuggled into the countries where the West wants to trigger the coups. And it's also psychological war. I mean, to promote this Guaido boy, who nobody even knew about in Venezuela before he was elected by the U.S. and its European cohorts.
Well, how would you set the record straight then? I mean, we hear lots about things like economic warfare. I mean, you've talked about how some people in industry in Venezuela, I mean, owners of big companies, etc. I mean, many people will find it incredible, Andre, that they would actually destroy their own markets for some sort of political reason. In other words, that they would create shortages deliberately. That sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory.
They do, Tony, and it's not conspiracy. I mean, I know these people from Bolivia, I know these people from Venezuela. They go against even principles of capitalism. Look, you are talking about the feudal, rulers there, and most of them of different ethnic groups than the majority of the population. These people were in charge of these countries for 5 centuries. So for them to, and they're so filthy rich that for them to lose $10 million, $20 million is nothing. I know people in Bolivia who are, one family could have senator in the family, owner of the newspaper and owner of the supermarket chain, for example. So these are feudal clans, and it's no conspiracy. You can look at it clearly and see what happened in Chile in 1973. It's exactly replaying the same scenario. And you are familiar. Okay. I know you wrote a lot about and you spoke a lot about Chile. Exactly the same thing happened in Chile.
Yeah. We're just going to bring Kevin Cahill in now, former Sunday Times journalist. Kevin.
The Salvador Allende's IT advisor was my friend, Stafford Beer. So I remember the coup against Allende very well. But you're talking about the long term, the feudal nature of the oligarchs, and I think you're right. My specialization was land, and this rule by the oligarchs, and I think there are the oligarchs on all sides. Money is what defines them, capital. And the anti-democratic stuff in America is a bunch of oligarchs, the exact equivalent of the oligarchs in Russia. But I think your thesis is correct. It's feudal in mentality.
Andre, you worked for Telesur English, haven't you? I mean, this is, I think, quite an amazing thing to have come out of Latin America. Will they be able to survive, do you think? And will Telesur survive? Will you be able to still make documentaries there?
No, Tony, let's correct this. I made 5 documentary films for Telesur from all over the world, and it was not for the English section. I mean, I was working for Telesur. My documentaries were made in Spanish.
I mean, do you want to just say something about who Telesur are for people who've never come across it, although there is an English version?
There is an English version, yes. I mean, but I do not work with them because I don't feel that Telesur in English really reflects the position of the Venezuelan government. I mean, there is too much anarcho-syndicalism from the West and too many people who are actually who infiltrated it from the, you know, defunct Western left. So I used to write for them after I made documentary films, but I'm not writing for them.
No, but
too
it's been what I'm trying to get to is it's been quite an important force nevertheless, hasn't it?
Yes, Telesur in Espanol, the Telesur is extremely important force, yes. I'm talking about the Telesur in English, but Telesur in Spanish language, original Telesur, is extremely important force. What will happen to them? It's not only Venezuelan project, it's pan-Latin American project, basically, hopefully going to survive, as I also hope that Venezuela is going to survive in the shape in which it is. If something happens to it, it's going to be a problem, for Telesur as well. But Telesur has producers, reporters from all over Latin America, so it's not only Venezuela.
What's your crystal ball then? Do you think Maduro will be able to tough this out in the face of psychological warfare, propaganda from the West, and also economic warfare?
I have no doubt that he will do his best, and I have no doubt that all of us who support the government will do our best. I'm writing a lot about this. I'm speaking to all television stations all over the world that are having me on Venezuela. But if Venezuela is going to be attacked, I have my luggage packed and I'm going. I mean, as I hope others would go to defend the revolution, because I think basically the hot spot. It's the most important place now where the battle for survival of the left is going to take place.
I mean, for people who've never been there, what sort of country is it?
It's a wonderful country with great culture. It's a very beautiful country, inhabited by very passionate people, as you can see, people who are very interested in everything from politics to arts, and they definitely have a great scale of different ideas, and these ideas, unlike in Europe, where everybody thinks that there is only one political system possible, in Venezuela it's not the case. In Venezuela there is a lot of different points of view. There is a lot of and people defend these points of view passionately. They fight for them, and so on and so on. It's just people like Guaido. People like Guaido, who is a handpicked puppet of the West. He has no passions or no idea. Political views. He's just basically repeating what he's asked to repeat.
Yeah, he's reading a script. This is what quite a lot of them do. You know, they don't speak from the heart. Anyway, look, while you're on, Andre, before you go, I just want to put something to you about Crimea, which came up in Prime Minister's. I hope you don't mind just hanging on a minute more. Which came up in Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons this week. So, if you just have a listen to that, we'll just get a comment from you when that's finished.
John Whittingdale!
Is my rightful friend aware that 5 years ago today, Russian special forces seized the government buildings in Crimea and raised the Russian flag? Will my rightful friend confirm that the UK government remains committed to the restoration of Ukrainian sovereignty over Crimea? And will she look at strengthening sanctions against Russia until that can be achieved?
I'm very happy to give that confirmation to my right honourable friend. This was an illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia, and we have been doing everything in relation to sanctions that we can to ensure that the appropriate sanctions are imposed that will have an impact. We have been one of the voices around the EU Council table that has been advocating at every stage, not just the rollover of sanctions, but ensuring that as we look at the actions of Russia here and elsewhere, we enhance those sanctions and rightfully put pressure on those who are responsible.
Now that's Theresa May and John Whittingdale. Andre, fifth anniversary of the annexation of Crimea.
Oh, yes. Annexation of Crimea. I mean, basically Crimea coming home, with some 90% of Russians living there and the population that voted democratically in referendum that they want to go home after the drunken stupor of Khrushchev, in which he gave Crimea to Ukraine, which was still part of the Soviet Union, as was Russia. So, I mean, what is more democratic than people voting, the overwhelming majority voting on coming home to the country where they historically always belonged? So all this is a continuation of propaganda, and the people like Theresa May are so desperate because they know that they are going to lose ideological war with the rest of the world, and that their crimes against humanity are being exposed now by independent media, that they are just shouting nonsense basically blocking even their own ears from hearing what the rest of the world is saying.
Well, we don't hear a lot, do we?
And censoring independent media, censoring RT, censoring other news outlets that are telling the truth.
Well, we've got, one of the things they never tell us about is the March 16th, 2014 referendum in Crimea, where the Crimean people voted 97% that they wanted to be remain, or actually to return to be part of the Russian Federation. Why is it that we don't hear that?
Well, this, you should ask this question to the censors of your media. I mean, ask the Guardian, because we are talking about it all the time. The RT, Telesur, Press TV, all the magazines and newspapers for which I write, we all talk about it all the time. The problem is they don't publish us.
And what about Crimea? Yeah. What about Crimea? I mean, we had the Crimean War with Winston Churchill many, many years ago. And what is the strategic importance of it? Maybe we can just finish on that one, Andre.
Strategic importance is to smear Russia. I mean, here they had some they could say that while the West is invading and everything and overthrowing anything on its way, Russia wants annex something what is its own, and what actually the population of the area there of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to join. So I mean, here they had at least some kind of a little bit of possibility to say, oh, Russia is invading as well. You see, so it's just a little propaganda trick, nothing else. I mean, there is really nothing. Strategically, it's important because it is controlling the water waves that are used by Ukraine, which European Union wants to lull into its ranks. And the result of all this, poor Ukrainian people. You know that Ukraine, after all this flirting with the West, and after antagonizing Russia, while Russia is now one of the richest countries in the world again, despite the sanctions, Ukraine has the minimum income, which is lower than in Indonesia. It's absolutely miserable. It's like it's below the Southeast Asian countries in terms of the quality of life and incomes. So you see where it all leads.
Well, I noticed also Poroshenko is being impeached, the president, and it's about to be re-elected, but it doesn't look like he'll do very well.
I mean, Poroshenko is basically a criminal. I went to West Africa to investigate his dealings with Cocoa. He's called the Chocolate King, you know. I mean, it's he's driving like like slaves of African people there on his cocoa plantations. I was almost murdered there. I was locked in my hotel when I was investigating, you know, in Abidjan. It's incredible what this person is doing. So what he's doing in Ukraine is just a reflection of what he's doing elsewhere, the Chocolate King.
Okay, Andre, where's a good place to keep up with what's happening in Venezuela and where to follow your work online?
Okay, you can just go to my website, but also just Google my name. My stuff is now all over in Global Research, on Global Research on 21st Century Wire, which is a British newswire, news agency. Then, you know, plenty of publications. I publish in NEO, which is a magazine of Academy of Science of Russian Federation. It's published in English. But maybe like 30, 40 sites. So just Google my name and it's all there. Put it online because my name is unpronounceable.
VLT. VLT.
VLTCHEK.
Lovely.
Nobody will get it. Nobody will be able
to. Okay, so I'll put up links on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to all that. Andre Vilcek, thanks very much for joining us.
After LA, I'm going down to Latin America, so you can contact me anytime. I will be happy to be on your show again.
Are you going to Venezuela?
I'm not going this time. I'm going to Bolivia, and I'm going to Mexico to work with the governments that are supporting, actually, Venezuela.
Okay, so be lovely. Maybe you could check in again in a few weeks' time.
Definitely.
Andre Vilcek, thanks very much for joining us. Kevin, what do you make of what we've been hearing there?
Well, Crimea was grabbed by Russia in the early 1700s, pretty well the same time we grabbed Gibraltar. And the same thing, it was an imperial grab. But Crimea became Russian over the next 200 years. And the referendum you mentioned is, I think, the decisive factor. That's what the people of the area, under the UN rules, said they wanted. They wanted to be reunited with Russia. So this
97% is quite a big majority, isn't it? It's not like the Brexit vote.
No, there was no division. The Crimea had become, over the 200 years between 1700, it had become Russian. And I think the Second World War had a good deal to do with it as well. But it's just propaganda. You know, it's the same problem. The media in the West, really, I mean, it sounds like we're being left. We're not. The media in the West is one-sided, incredibly one-sided. The idea of giving the public the facts and letting the public decide seems to have been lost.
So why is balance gone from so much of our London press? Why is that? Because balance is something, you know, we as journalists are taught to make. Yeah. You've got to try and show both sides.
This is the key. Go back to the 2 weeks ago, the House of Commons Digital Committee produced its report on Facebook. And the chair had a lovely snappy phrase to describe Facebook. He described Facebook as a bunch of digital gangsters. So that caught the headlines. What nobody looked at was what was really in the report. If you look carefully, the report had set out to be a big splash about Russian interference in the referendum. There was Russian interference. It was negligible, but it was on the same side as the oligarchs in the United States putting their money in through Aaron Banks and people. The Russian interference wanted us out of the EU too. So, of course, nobody picked it up and you know, developed it. So there's one sample. I mean, how would the English public feel if all this razzmatazz about Russian interference turned out to be a con, which it is?
Why do you say that, then?
Because the issue is balance. The United States spends at minimum of $60 billion a year interfering in Russia, interfering in Russian elections, interfering in Russian social life, interfering in Russian politics.
Well, you know what? Since the Brexit vote, I've heard loads more US voices on the BBC. All the time, we seem to be getting them on Radio 4, on the World Service. In fact, it was wonderful this week, and what I'll do is I'll see if I can get a recording of it and play it next week, maybe, is where the guy from Chatham House was actually introduced by the BBC World Service presenter as a former CIA. And this is what we seem to be getting all the time. It's basically an intelligence people posing as independent experts.
Chatham House has literally become an extended arm of the CIA. They have no objectivity, and they have no respect for... Chatham House is meant to be an institution in our country. The only thing it does in relation to the British public is treated with contempt.
I seem to remember, maybe you can confirm this or deny it or whatever, but actually the Council on Foreign Relations and Chatham House and other institutes for international affairs around, particularly around Europe, they're in France, Germany, Czech Republic, were initially seed funded, the British and the American ones anyway, through Cecil Rhodes' will. Because he was around at a time at the late 19th century. He basically took over Africa. I mean, he was exploiting Africa for its mineral resources and making a fortune. And as the British Empire was expanding in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Cecil Rhodes thought, well, if we carry on like this, we could take over the world. Mm. And so in his will, he put his money towards setting up what he called, in the early wills, he took it out of the later wills, a secret society that the British could use to take over the world. The British Empire would just simply grow and grow. Now, that I that's certainly my reading of what Chatham House is it grew out of that. The idea that we've got a very powerful private interests in Britain that could set up think tanks that would basically steer foreign policy. And the trouble is now, as we've got small government, we've got right-wing party in the States and in Britain trying to reduce the size of government and increase the power of big business, that big business is actually calling the shots at Chatham House, not the Foreign Office.
At Chatham House in particular, it's American institutions like the Heritage Foundation and there are several others that are calling the shots. Chatham House is not objective. I was a member once, but it's not objective. It's completely tilted.
So every time you hear Chatham House on the BBC...
you're hearing the American spooks.
Okay, well, we're not going to be hearing the American spooks now. We're going to go over to look at the what's been going on in Lebanon. Well, nothing much has been happening in Lebanon itself, but here in London, the Home Secretary, Saeed Javid, has now classing the political wing of Hezbollah, which is a major part in the government of Lebanon, as a terrorist organisation. So does that mean that if the foreign minister, who happens to be from Hezbollah, walks out of the Lebanese embassy in London, he's going to be arrested as a terrorist?
Well, that's the implication. But anyway,
so let's have a listen now quickly, just before we go on to discuss that further, to Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, which Andre Vilcek was talking about then, mentioned. And I asked Patrick Henningsen about Hezbollah. What is Hezbollah? Clearly, it's a major feature of the government now in Lebanon. But what is it?
Hezbollah is a resistance movement which sprung out of South Lebanon and is a direct result. This is an important part, and I do recommend people reading a few good books on this, including Hala Jaber's book, which is entitled Hezbollah. They're a direct result of the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And so if Israel didn't occupy South Lebanon for the number of years that it did, there would be no Hezbollah, quite possibly. So it's a resistance movement and a defense force which emerged out of that situation. And of course, after every civil war or after every war, militias will tend to move into politics. This is not unusual. We see this in Ireland as well. We see this in many other places. In fact, this is the norm throughout history, and no different in Lebanon. This is exactly what's happened in Lebanon. So as they've matured and as they've moved and as the war subsided in Lebanon, then they moved into politics. They are a power bloc, but they have a religious element to them, and they have this terrorist allegations and history, whichever way you want to interpret that, which goes back to the early 1980s. And so they have been designated in the past as a terrorist group by the United States.
That's Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire.
What he's talking about is repeated throughout history. I mean, in Ireland, the British occupation after the rebellion became so onerous. The next thing is you've got an independent republic.
But what about this whole business? Saeed Javid is now saying officially in British law, Hezbollah, political wing, are terrorists.
Well, the Home Secretary has a wonderful record. Look at Windrush and all the rest of it. But he doesn't seem to see the contradiction. And of course, this foreign minister of Lebanon will not be arrested outside the embassy. And our Home Secretary will be made to look the idiot he has been behaving like recently over other things.
Well, put this to Patrick about why is that Hezbollah, and what is the truth to whether Hezbollah actually is a terrorist group or not? Because it certainly has had a lot of terrorist attacks attributed to it.
The only argument that anybody's made in terms of Hezbollah being a terrorist organization goes back to the early 1980s, and they will always trot out the same arguments, which is that the Hezbollah did the U.S. Barracks bombing, which killed 240-odd Marines. Sorry if I get the number wrong on that. And that's taken as fact, when in fact, if you read the history of Hezbollah and what was going on in the Lebanese Civil War, Hezbollah wasn't fully formed by that time. But it's being automatically attributed, especially by the Americans and the Israelis, and as a Hezbollah terrorist attack, and it was being directed by the Iranian state, because I believe one of the drivers in this car bombing of what happened was Iranian. Okay, so this is how the narrative goes. This is how the story goes. There's another one. I think it was another attack. I believe it might have been in Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure. I don't have the details in front of me, but that was a U.S. investigation that deemed it to be Hezbollah. Then you have the Bulgarian bus bombing, which is a very dubious case to begin with, and Israel has attributed that to Hezbollah. The reality is Hezbollah defeated Israel on the battlefield in 2006 and effectively expelled Israel from occupying its buffer zone in South Lebanon. Okay. Now, that's historical fact, and if one's to comment on that, that was a defense operation by a sovereign state. Israel doesn't have a real claim on saying that was a terrorist organization that evicted them from Lebanon. That is the domestic defense force of southern Lebanon.
Patrick Henningsen again.
Very good. No, and this is... years ago I was in Lebanon, and the appalling crisis that occurred there. But the Israeli invasion was a total disaster, and its bad effects are still there. But as you say, quite correctly, Israel has no rights in South Lebanon. It's an occupation force.
Well, it will say it's a buffer zone. It needs to let South Lebanon as a buffer zone.
Buffer zones don't exist in law. It's Lebanese territory, and if Israel has soldiers in there, then Israel is occupying the territory.
Well, interestingly, we had a newspaper editor from Hezbollah here in Bristol back in February 2008 at the council house, and there was a little bit of a protest. There was one of these Sionim turned up who was basically pro-Israeli, trying to disrupt the whole affair. But actually, the chap gave, I thought, a fascinating insight into what's You know, actually, wasn't it the first library in the world in Lebanon? In Tyre or Byblos, maybe?
Byblos, almost certainly. Alexandria was the great one in historic times, but yes. It was an incredibly civilized country.
Going back away. And so let's have a listen now to just a clip from this talk, which was given by Ibrahim Moussaoui, who came all the way here to Bristol. There were some articles criticizing him in the press, but he was brought over by Stop the War and was an absolutely fascinating person to listen to here in the Council House here in Bristol in February 2008. So let's have a little clip now where he talks about self-defense in Lebanon.
If you want to tell the people that you don't want wars, what do? You have many things that you can do. You can demonstrate in the streets, voice out your anger, vent out your anger, and say, I'm against it. You can take measures. But if it's your country, what do you have to do? It's your moral duty. It's your responsibility. And it is your right. A natural right, a human right. It's a human right. It's an international law right. It's the natural law, it's the human doctrine that you have to defend yourself and you have to protect your country and you have to liberate it. Our country under occupation, we did not go to any country and occupy it. We did not steal anybody's water or oil or there hasn't been any soil theft from the Lebanese side, from Hezbollah side. They have always fought on the Lebanese territories to protect the Lebanese people and to liberate Lebanese territories from occupation and invasion. Do you call this terrorism? And when we do this, we are sending a very simple message. We're saying that life is too important to us. We love life. We respect life. It's a gift given by God, by our magnificent God, to be free souls, to live in complete dignity and freedom. Otherwise, no meaning for our life. When you are dignified, when you live with dignity and freedom and independence, then this is the life. And if you live under humiliation and occupation and oppression, this is the death. So you better live while your head is up and not live humiliated all of your life. That's why we fight. And we tell them, when we fight them back, we tell them the war is costly. You cannot come and invade. It's not a picnic. You're going to be killed as an invading force and as an occupation army.
So that's the voice there of Hezbollah's newspaper editor, and that's Ibrahim Moussaoui speaking in Bristol's Council House in February 2008. A very big audience. But his main point there, I suppose, Kevin, is self-defence or terrorism. And he got a big round of applause, and he's saying, well, we're actually doing self-defence. Do you call this terrorism?
No, I don't. It goes back, there's a cliche back in the 70s of one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And that is what he is saying. But he has right on his side. He's speaking as a Lebanese person and the right to defend his country and indeed the lives of his people, which is an absolute right in all the charters, the UN charter and everywhere else. And provoking war in Lebanon was a total disaster. I mean, to take a sample back here, in 1972, the British Army shot just 12 people compared with losses elsewhere. And the IRA tripled in size overnight. And we found ourselves with a terrorist war that lasted 40 years. That was the price of shooting, of murdering 12 people.
So the Israeli government will see this as a victory. Hezbollah has been now classed as a terrorist organisation in Britain.
It's a propaganda victory, but it's a mistake in law and it's a mistake in reality.
What about little bit south of Lebanon is Israel, and we've got elections next month, well, it's March now, in April, over there because of the collapse of Netanyahu's coalition. And I spoke also to Patrick Henningsen about this whole idea of the far right now starting to move in, possibly for the first time in 30 years, into the Knesset, because Netanyahu may be doing deals with them. Well, he's being forced, in fact, to do deals with them.
So where do you go when you don't have allies? Where do you go to fish for for support, where you go to sort of the periphery of the pond to fish for potential allies. That also might sound familiar to some people. And so a desperate government, a desperate Likud party, a desperate Netanyahu has allied with the fringes of the Israeli right, the really hard right, of the, what is the equivalent of the Jewish National Front in Israel. So this is hugely problematic on a number of levels. One of the main levels in which this is hugely problematic is how this is interpreted by American Jewry and the American wing of the Israeli lobby. So they're going to have problems with this. America is not a monolithic, hardline Jewish population. There, it's a wide spectrum. It's a diverse mosaic, and there's a lot of liberal Jews in America that don't support the hardline policies of Benjamin Netanyahu, and even less so in recent years. And so it's an interesting time we're living in right now, where the Jewish lobby is much more aggressive. Certainly under the Trump administration, this is one of the most tightest presidents with Israel and with the Jewish lobby. The move of the embassy to Jerusalem was just the beginning of that. So while they're being aggressive, more aggressive and more sort of offensive in their political ambitions in America and in Britain, at the same time, there's a backlash that's forming two Israeli policies, and you can count some of that down to the increase in interest in the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement globally, and that is a direct result probably of Israeli operations like Protective Edge and some of these other sieges that have been put upon Gaza, which Israel calls anti-terror operations, but that Palestinians and their supporters globally will call state-sanctioned terrorism.
Patrick Henningsen again. Gaza, a bit of a difficult one, Kevin. I mean, terrorists, do you think the Israelis are right to say they're terrorists?
Well, the UN has just literally yesterday or this morning said that the shootings of the unarmed Palestinians and the children at the wire in Gaza is a crime against humanity, almost certainly. And again, to take the comparison, if the British Army has shot 189 unarmed children, press people, medical people, I mean, there'd be no end to it.
But well, Yuval Steinitz is in the Israeli cabinet, and it looks like in the new government, if Netanyahu manages to stay in power, he could well become foreign minister. And I thought it's quite interesting to look a little bit ahead at what kind of foreign minister we could be getting. And here he is speaking about Gaza a couple of months ago.
Well, personally, I always think that if you don't have serious strategic goals for a war or for a military campaign, don't do it. And I didn't see any serious plan to achieve something significant in Gaza. I mean, if we decide to occupy Gaza, to uproot the terrorist regime there, and to enable Abu Mazen to resume control of Gaza, then we have to consider it. We will pay a price for it. It's not easy to capture Gaza, casualties and other prices. Yes. But since this is not currently on the table, we don't have to go to a war without serious, significant targets.
Again, he's saying Gaza is a terrorist camp, effectively.
Well, certainly Gaza is full of people who oppose Israel because they have been ghettoized. Gaza is actually a ghetto. It's a Palestinian ghetto, but it's been created by Israel, and the conditions in Gaza are intolerable.
Anyway, let's have a listen now finally to the Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. He's an American who is just speaking about, he was just about to do a speech actually, at a big Jewish convention, which is, generally speaking, most of the people there, a massive stadium full of them in the US, opposed to Zionism and opposed to the whole idea of the state of Israel.
According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political. It's national. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is completely religious. A Jew, by definition, is somebody who accepted the Jewish religion or who is defined as a Jew by the Jewish religion. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political, and it's defined the same way we define the identity of any nationals, like a Frenchman or a Canadian. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is centered only around God and God's teachings, nothing else. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is centered around a nation state, which they randomly decided is the nation state that was created in 1948 that they call Israel. According to Judaism, a Jew is supposed to have certain character traits. He's supposed to eschew violence. He's supposed to oppose violence. He's supposed to be disgusted by violence. Even in the olden days when Jews had to defend themselves, that was considered nothing to glorify. Jews don't have military heroes. We have religious heroes. Our heroes are the righteous. Our heroes are the scholars. The heroes of the Zionists are the war heroes. The Jews have no national sites where wars took place, such as the Alamo in America. Jews are not militant. Jews are religious. Jews are, the way the Bible describes us, a nation of priests and a holy people. If people want to retain their Jewish identity, if they want to resist the propaganda that is churned out by Zionists and Zionism every day, then it is vital that they take proactive steps to defend themselves against it. Look, the Zionist propaganda is everywhere. We live in a world where every day this message that has been deliberately promulgated by the Zionists is fed to us. Israel, Jewish state, Israel, Jews, Israel, the Jewish people, Israel protects the Jews. It's all bogus.
That is Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. Links again to that on our show page. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at this week, one word, .org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Hopefully, Martin Summers will be back. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
FM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.